This is October 21st, 2012, and it's my birthday. There you go. Thank you. How old am I? I'm 66 years old. I don't know how that happened. So, yeah, it's my birthday, and it's tomorrow. It'll be 5 months ago that my son, Ivan, died. And so a topic presented itself is birth and death. It's hard to think of a topic that's more central for Buddhism and certainly central to the story of Shakyamuni Buddha. It's birth and death is our life. It's the reality that that we come to terms with to one degree or another. And as we move through life, we find out more and more about death. And things change. Things shift. A lot of people who think that Buddhism is kind of a negative, pessimistic religion because death is talked about quite a bit. It's really in sharp contrast to Western culture, where it's swept under the rug, embalmed in a corner. But the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, there are those who forget that death will come to all. For those who remember, quarrels come to an end. It's the great leveler. We're all in this boat together. None of us know when we may die, but we all know that we will. And when we remember, quarrels do tend to come to an end. I had a friend, talked about him once before, old high school friend, who worked for about a year on a really intense project, putting in 60, 70-hour weeks, getting the financial news network, the CNN spinoff, up on the air. I don't know if it even exists anymore. But when it was done, everybody was given a vacation. And so he promptly had a heart attack. And in his work, there had been somebody he'd worked with who was really difficult to deal with. And if he says they're difficult to deal with, they certainly were, because he's worked with some real champs. Who's that guy who's got the immigration problem? Lou Dobbs. Yeah, he worked for Lou Dobbs, among others. And yeah, Lou's a piece of work, evidently. Hate to have that go out on the internet, but that's what I heard. So anyway, he's on his hospital gurney. His wife has gotten him in there. They're not sure if he's going to live or die. And he suddenly realized, I have to forgive that guy. I can't die without forgiving that guy. And he did. And he, of course, survived because he told me the story. And when he went back to work, he looked the guy up and he made amends. You know, in any situation where we're having trouble with someone, regardless of the fact that we know it's all their fault, there are amends that we can make. And he basically said, you know, I don't have any hard feelings against you. And it worked out. The guy was kind of surprised. But what a healthy thing to do. And what a blessing to come that close to your death and suddenly understand what's important and what's not. Roshi likes to say, we all know the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. This is really a motivation to practice. We don't know how long we have, but we know we don't have all the time in the world, that's for sure. But it's hard to really take that in. And looking around for some fodder for this topic, I came across a French philosopher All I know is his name is E, his first initial is E, and his last name is Moran, M-O-R-I-N. He said, man is a being that knows death but can't believe it. And that's really our situation. It's from time to time we get a wake-up call, but for the most part, it's just in the background. It's not something that we think about a whole lot. It probably is at the root of much of our anxiety, much of the suffering that we find we manufacture for ourselves in our lives comes from, if you could trace it all the way back, comes from this knowledge that we're going to die. Life is a tragedy that's unfolding, looked at from the point of view of me. The moment we were born, we're on our way. There's a They Might Be Giants song. You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older. And now you're even older. And now you're even older. Your life is coming to an end, and now it's even sooner. And now it's even sooner. Great song. So I'm going to just briefly hear this whole question of how do we get in touch with this reality? You know, how do we realize that the stakes are real? There's so many things where we know it, but we don't quite get it. And my old friend Anthony DeMello has a passage that I've read before, and I'm going to inflict him on you again. It's a little section that's entitled The End of Analysis. He says, I want to give you a taste of the difference between analysis and awareness, or information on the one hand and insight on the other. Information is not insight. Analysis is not awareness. Knowledge is not awareness. Suppose I walked in here with a snake crawling up my arm and I said to you, do you see the snake crawling up my arm? I've just checked in an encyclopedia before coming to this session, and I found out that this snake is known as a Russell's viper. If it bit me, I would die inside half a minute. Would you kindly suggest ways and means by which I could get rid of this creature that is crawling up my arm? Who talks like this? I have information, but I've got no awareness. Or say I'm destroying myself with alcohol. Kindly describe ways and means by which I could get rid of this addiction. A person who would say that has no awareness. He knows he's destroying himself, but he is not aware of it. If he were aware of it, the addiction would drop that minute. If I were aware of what the snake was, I wouldn't brush it off my arm. It would get brushed off through me. That's what I'm talking about. That's the change I'm talking about. You don't change yourself. It's not me changing me. Change takes place through you, in you. That's about the most adequate way I can express it. You see change take place in you, through you, in your awareness, it happens. You don't do it. When you're doing it, it's a bad sign. It won't last. And if it does last, God have mercy on the people you're living with, because you're going to be very rigid. People who are converted on the basis of self-hatred and self-dissatisfaction are impossible to live with. Somebody said, if you want to be a martyr, marry a saint. Has anybody ever noticed this? You live for months and years with some bad habit, and then finally you get it together and you extinguish it. Maybe you talk too much and you decided, okay, I'm going to cut back on my talking. And all of a sudden you become hugely intolerant of those people who haven't improved their behavior as you just did. The saying, there's no prude like a reformed whore. It's really interesting to look at. When you have that come up, when you see yourself suddenly critical of people who are doing things that you yourself were doing yesterday, then you can be sure you're not quite getting at it the right way. when you realize what you're doing and why you're doing it, when you come to awareness, when you suddenly realize, I talk too much, I don't like it, and you just, it just drops away, that's so much different than deciding, okay, for this term intensive, I'm going to cut out talking. That's a great thing to do, because you'll learn a lot about whatever it is you're trying to eliminate. Term intensives are marvelous in the things that we can learn, but it doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And I think many people who've done a term intensive and have increased their zazen or done more exercise or whatever are chagrined to find that a month after the term intensive has ended, they're back to the same habits they came in with. It's working with yourself and trying to change your behavior is not an easy thing to do. And the best thing we can do is to wake up to whatever degree we can. The more that we see what's going on, the easier it is to make changes that are hard to make just because we think we should, and just because we want to be a good person or we want to look good to others, measure up to our teacher, our friends. So he says, if you want to be a martyr, marry a saint. But in awareness, you keep your softness, your subtleness, your gentleness, your openness, your flexibility, and you don't push. Then change occurs. So let's come back to this whole question of death. There are really two sides to it. And the first is that death is way more certain and way more final and way more real than we think. When Ivan died, it was just, you start out with denial. I mean, it's just get a phone call and there it is. You can't really take it in. But there's no appeal process. It can't be taken back. You know, once things happen, they've happened. It's amazing that we don't immediately see this, but it's totally true. And beyond death, you know, just someone gets sick, you get sick. Fail to get in the college you want to get into. Get fired from your job. So many different things that can happen that are like a death. We keep bumping into it. It's like a missing tooth. Keep finding, oh wow, that's right, my tooth fell out. Or worse, an aching tooth, you bite down wrong, and it's, oh damn it. Or that thing that happens when you bite the inside of your cheek and then it's swelling up so you bite it 20 more times. The whole stages of grief business, denial, anger, bargaining, acceptance, not sure exactly what the official order is, and it certainly doesn't necessarily go in any official order, but it's just us bumping up against what is and having it not match with what we want. Nothing can be taken back. When time is wasted or opportunities are missed, they're gone forever. I spent a number of years drinking more than I should, and those years are gone. It's not a tragedy, it's a reality. But there's so many things where, you know, we have a conversation with someone, we don't know it's our last conversation with them. Even if it's not our last conversation, that's the only one we're going to have in that place and that time. And if we're not there, if we have a foot out the door, if we're not really listening, not really present, then that's gone. Boom. Life moves on so incredibly quickly. People come to practice, and it's great. You know, I love practice. But then something comes up in their lives, and they've got to set it on a shelf for a while, and whoosh, they're down the stream. When do they come back? It's years sometimes. It's amazing. You know, people who were here at the center back in the 70s or the 80s, you know, sometimes show up. It's 20 years later. Where did that time go? You know, now they're ready. And you can't quarrel with it. You miss the time, and then you come back, and that's it. That's the way things are. Really, all we have is this moment, you know. And every time we bump up against something that isn't the way we want it to be, we're returned to this moment. If we pay attention, we begin to learn. We begin to take in cause and effect. Begin to see how little habits pile up. Totally innocent, doodling around on the internet. All of a sudden, it's an hour past our bedtime. Moment of inattention, spill the soup. Bump into the car in front of us. Just fail to connect with somebody. This running out of time. So another great thing that term intensives point up, you sign up for your first one and you think, okay, I'm going to step my sitting up, that'll be good, and I think I'll work on, maybe I'll do some more exercises. I've always wanted to learn these chants, I'll do that. Maybe I'll do a little picking up in my neighborhood, that sounds good. And you have this laundry list of things and you think about it, do I have time to do all these things? Yeah, of course I do, I've got a lot of time. And then all those little habits of taking a minute for this and a minute for that pile up, and people suddenly realize, I can't get it done. I ran out of time. You know, I missed my sitting commitment. I missed this or I missed that. You really understand how there are times when you just have to move on to the next thing. You don't have time to check out Nate Silver's column in the New York Times and see how Obama and Barack Obama and Mitt Romney are doing, or whatever addiction you may have. We're just gonna get caught up again and again. It's just the nature of being human and imperfect. It's fair to say that everybody in this room is imperfect. It's also fair to say everybody is perfect, but we'll talk about that side a little later. And we can't be constantly aware of reality. Of the fact that we're going to die, of the fact that our desire is bringing us suffering. We have to suffer more. We have to bump up against it to begin to take it in. If we do take it in, if we do learn from our pain, then we do get wiser as we get older. It actually does work, but there's so many things where we're just set up for disaster because we want things to be a certain way, because we don't want discomfort. The comedian Louis C.K. has got a great, great nose for this. He said once, parents bring home a puppy, they might as well say, "Hey kids, it's a new puppy. We're all going to cry someday." I look at my dog and, you know, the odds are I'll outlive him. And that is not a whole lot I can do about it. When Ivan died, I just kept finding myself crying. And it was actually what made me cry was every time somebody said or did something kind. It was just like clockwork, you know, just say something sympathetic or do something wonderful, and I'd start to weep. I didn't even know why I was weeping. Probably not important. And it wasn't necessarily even bad. It was just, there were just tears. There are a lot of Zen stories about, there's one I can think of about a master whose favorite disciple dies, and someone comes to see him, and he's sitting on the floor wailing. They say, "You're a Zen master. You know about birth and death. How can it be that you're crying from something that just happens to all of us?" He said, "If I didn't cry now, when my most beloved disciple has died, when would I cry?" It's just waves come and go. Grief comes up. Joy comes up. Disappointment comes up. We don't have to edit it. It may change through our awareness, but it's not our job to be different at any moment than we are. Really, our only job is just to be here, to be at home. Sometimes that's weeping. Sometimes it's laughing. It's great. It's such a simple job. It's such a fruitful job. Such a human job. You know, you don't have to wear a special robe. You don't have to walk a special way. You don't have to talk in some stilted form. Just have to be you. Just have to open your eyes. There's this other side to birth and death. And that is that it's just simple reality. It's the way things are. It's baked in. There's never been a moment when we weren't going to die. There's never been any certainty about when anyone would go. When Ivan died, he had converted to Islam. And I went to the local imam here in Rochester, a man named Mohammed Shafiq, who's actually been here to the center. He's brought students here a number of times, so we know each other. And he was one of the people who made me cry. Very, very, very kind. But one of the things he said was, in Islam, life is a gift. It's a gift from God. And when we're asked to give the gift back, we should give it back gladly. We've just borrowed it. Of course, we don't want to give it back. It's really an interesting system they have in Islam. He told me there's a period of mourning. The body is buried almost immediately if you're a good Muslim, and there's a period of mourning. I think it's 3 or 4 days, and then the bereaved go back to work. That's it. It's just boom, you're back in your regular workaday world. And I guess it works for people in that faith. Here in the West, it usually takes us longer. I think for everybody, it's an open wound for a long time. Maybe it's an open wound forever. But that's okay. That's actually great. Every time we feel that pain, come up against that anxiety or whatever it is, we're returned. There's a woman named Byron Katie who was a bit of a sensation for a while. I'm not going to get into everything she said. She's a pretty remarkable woman, I think. But she said about feeling stress, feeling, you know, unhappiness, whatever, anxiety. Says, really, what it is it's a compassionate alarm clock. It's a message from the universe telling us you're lost in the dream. It's really, if there's any purpose to suffering, it's to make us sort of take stock, come back, be present. If it's worry and anxiety especially, there's so many things that we poison our lives with worrying about, and you can't worry about something and be in the present. It's really hard to do. And it's so easy to just take a breath. Doesn't have to be special. This moment doesn't need to be anything. We don't need to manufacture anything. We just need to touch base, check in. Everything is changing constantly. We don't have to change it. As DeMello says, through our awareness, change happens. The Buddha taught there were three inalterable aspects to reality. And they're impermanence, suffering, and no self. And if you look at it, if you think about it, and it's not a bad idea to think about it, it's not a bad idea to take a little time and think about reality. If you think about it, they're just unassailable. And nothing is permanent. Everything changes. Everything is in flux. Life is suffering. Things never work out exactly the way we want. And as a result, we suffer, more or less. More if we're kicking and screaming, and less if we can go with it, if we can go along with it. But inevitably, we have sickness, old age, and death. As long as we're in these bodies, it's going to be a bumpy ride. And finally, there is no self. There is no little me, no I, no little person, no unchanging thing. We're not things. Everybody dies, but there isn't a thing that dies. We're a process. The process goes on. It just isn't John anymore. Joko, I have this metaphor that I've trotted out a million different times in little introductory talks, and reading through some material, I realized that I must have inhaled it years ago from Joko Beck, because she has a little section, so I'll give her credit for it. You can think of the self as a little eddy or a whirlpool in a stream. You know, the stream is flowing along, and there are branches and twigs and whatnot, and little rocks and whatnot, and as it moves by one, it forms a little whirlpool. And we can see it, talk about it, I can point it out to someone. But that whirlpool is not a thing. It's just a pattern. It's water moves into it, water moves out of it. There's nothing that stays there. And if the twig is pulled out of the river, Where did the whirlpool go? It's just flowing downstream. It's really what our lives are like. But because we think we're a thing, and we think others are things, it's really, really upsetting to us that it has to end, that it has to change. We're just a pattern in the stream of life. A messy pattern, or a compassionate pattern, or unhappy pattern. And it's going to change. We're not the same person we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago. For some of us, we're not the same person we were 66 years ago. And we're going to keep on changing. All there is this moment, constantly changing and not subject to our preferences. There's a story, famous Zen story. I used to hear it all the time. I never could quite get comfortable with it. I'm sure you've heard it. There's a man being chased by a tiger, and he runs to the edge of the cliff, and he realizes he can get out of harm's way by diving over the edge of the cliff and hanging onto a vine. So he does. He's there on that vertical face, both hands around a vine. It's not too terribly secure. And he looks down, and there's another tiger down at the bottom, just waiting for him to fall. And then, to make things more exciting, there are a couple mice that crawl out on the face of the cliff, and they start gnawing on the vine. And the way the story goes, he's hanging there, and he notices there's some strawberries growing right there. Actually, I think it'd more likely be raspberries, but let's just say there's some berries. And he reaches out one hand and he picks it, and it's delicious. And that's the end of the story. Obviously, he's going to fall and he's going to die. But in that moment, the strawberry is delicious. It's really where we're at. I always wanted to, but what could he do not to fall? I just never liked that story. Actually, I'll read another one. This is also from Joko Beck. It's sort of the same point. It's a section, this is from a book of hers called Nothing Special, Living Zen. It's really just a collection of talks that she gave, but they're pretty good. Anyway, this section is called The Fall. She says, there was once a man who climbed to the top of a 10-story building and jumped off. As he passed the fifth floor on his way down, he was heard to say, "So far, so good." We laugh at the man because we see what's coming up for him in a moment. How can he say he's doing well so far? What's the difference between the second when he is at the fifth floor and the second just before he hits the pavement? The second before hitting the pavement is what most of us would call a crisis. We think that if we have only a few minutes or days before we die, most of us would say, this is a crisis. On the other hand, if our days are proceeding normally, the usual job, the usual people, the usual tasks, life may not seem wonderful, but at least we're used to it. At such times, we don't feel we're in a crisis, and we may not feel impelled to practice with diligence. Let's look at this supposed difference between crisis and non-crisis. So the point she's making is, We're all at the fifth floor. Things are going pretty well. She goes on to say something about Sesshin, which is great. She says Sesshin, that's for people who may be listening to this who don't know, Sesshin is a formal meditation retreat. Here at the center, we sit for a Sesshin 10 hours a day. It's done completely in silence. It's a lot of sitting. It's pretty demanding. She says Sesshin is an artificial crisis. When we commit ourselves to a retreat, we have to stay and struggle with a difficult situation. Of course, we stay and struggle with others. We have others there doing the same crazy thing that we're doing. By the end of the retreat, most of us have gone through the crisis, at least enough so that we see our life somewhat differently. It's sad that we don't understand that each moment of our lives, drinking a cup of coffee, walking down the street to pick up a paper, is it. Why don't we grasp that truth? We don't get it because our little minds think that this second that we're living has hundreds of thousands of seconds that preceded it and hundreds and thousands of seconds still to come, so we turn away from truly living our life. It's the old been there, done that. Instead, we do what human beings spend all their time doing, which is a complete waste of time. We try mentally to scheme so that we will never have to suffer through a crisis. We spend all our energies trying to be liked, successful, nice, agreeable, assertive, or non-assertive, depending on what we think will do it for us. We have schemes. Most of our energies go into these schemes as we try to handle our life so that we never hit the bottom. That's why it's so wonderful to get close to that bottom. That's why people who are seriously ill or who have a devastating circumstance in their lives often wake up. Wake up to what? What do we wake up to? Then here in this copy, her students trot out a bunch of answers, and she says, yep, the wonder of this second. When this second is not me or anything else, but just, oh. And that doesn't mean some giant emotion, but just that all of our worries are non-existent. But usually we have such a realization only when we are pressed hard enough that our mind is pulled into the present moment. Then we can forget all our schemes of fixing ourselves, somebody else, fixing somebody else, or fixing circumstances. Most people spend 50 to 90% of their waking hours trying to avoid the bottom, yet we can't avoid it. We're all on our way down, every one of us. We can't avoid the bottom, but we spend most of our life trying to do that. Waking up means realizing that our situation is hopeless and wonderful. Then she points out the two views I'm talking about. From one point of view, we're always in crisis. We're always falling toward the bottom. From another point of view, there is no crisis. If we're going to die in 1 second, is there any crisis? No, there's just that second. 1 second we're alive, 1 second we're dead. There's no crisis, there's just what is. But the human urge to do the impossible keeps us mucked up. And say the human unwillingness to see reality for what it is, to see impermanence, to see suffering, to see no self, to see death. We're like little children, kicking and screaming, as we can't accept what is. It's time to go to bed. No! Stay up! You have to go to bed. Even a little bit beginning to come into accord with the way things are has a huge effect on the way we experience our life. It's magical. It's amazing. course, if we try to see reality in order to make things magical, that usually doesn't work. But the extent to which we can just say, okay, I've got a tough day. It's a chainsaw outside the window. My wife is angry at me because I was stupid. I did something foolish. My leg hurts. Not that good a dancer. All those things. It's okay. There's something I read, I trolled through Eckhart Tolle, just a little gauge of how desperate I was for this talk. Actually, I love Eckhart Tolle, but and I found something in there that would really, really just is great, sums up this second point of view. He was talking about Krishnamurti. Said J. Krishnamurti, I don't know if people know about him. Used to be more popular maybe than he is now, but he says the great Indian philosopher and spiritual teacher. Said he spoke and traveled almost continuously all over the world for more than 50 years, attempting to convey through words, which are content, that which is beyond words, beyond content. The description of Zen, teaching beyond words, pointing directly. At one of his talks in the later part of his life, he surprised his audience by asking, "Do you want to know my secret?" Everyone became very alert. Many people in the audience had been coming to listen to him for 20 or 30 years and still failed to grasp the essence of his teaching. Finally, after all these years, the master would give them the key to understanding. "This is my secret," he said. "I don't mind what happens." And as Eckhart Tolle comments later, "What happens, of course, refers to the suchness of this moment, which already is as it is." It's really exactly what Zen Master Linji said when he said, "There's nothing I dislike." It's truly an advanced state. And it's not something you want to try to manufacture. It's just something that you gradually soaks into you, that things are okay the way they are. Tragedy can happen. Is it a tragedy? Is it not a tragedy? How would we know? How would we even know? We cry, we laugh. Where is there a problem? Sometimes it's sad, sometimes it's happy. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. As long as we're here, as long as we're awake, as long as we're doing this simple, simple job, lose count, go back to one. That's all there is. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.